pressing very hard. Okay, so you were talking about how you were doing night duty and boudoir.
Yeah, it was the chronic disease hospital, so there were a few deaths every night, and my main job was signing the death certificates in the morning and dealing with any major crises. But if it was really major, I would have to call the real administrative people anyway. But the main inducement for me, they did pay me, and the city system did pay better than Beth Israel, but it was also the room that I had, which was the top floor facing Manhattan, and it was just what people pay a lot of money for now, for a view, and I was getting it for nothing along with being paid. And it was a break from being at the hospital where I did most of the work at Beth Israel.
Now, was as chief resident, was that in hematology?
Internal medicine.
In internal medicine.
I continued my hematology interest and some research all the way through.
You did.
Published a few papers even while I was a resident. But the training was internal medicine across the board.
And when you were through with your residencies and your fellowship, you went?
Well, early in my residencies, I think it was maybe in my first year, I've forgotten, the Korean War broke out, and I had been deferred on an occupational basis while I was a medical student. There was a shortage of doctors. The doctor's draft law had not yet been enacted, and the draft boards were asked to reclassify the people that had been deferred. And mine suggested that I had the option of taking a commission, which they would be happy about, rather than serve as a private. And that made sense, so I applied for a commission in the Air Force. I had always, as I said, I made model airplanes. So I was interested in flying. So I signed up. I was called for processing for active duty when I was assistant resident, and the processing board reviewed each of the recalls. I was a little unusual in that the recalls were essentially World War II personnel that had stayed in the reserve. In the reserve, you got some pay and put in a day a month or something. I guess they all figured that nothing would happen. They'd never get called back to active duty, but this thing came along. And so all of them were pilots and navigators that had stayed in the reserve and were being recalled. And the review board was fairly hard-nosed about the sad stories that they were being told. I just started a business, I got married, I've got a kid now, and all that, as you'd expect in the post-war period. But they were hearing it over and over, and they needed the personnel. When they came to me, they wanted to know what I was doing. And of course, I hadn't been in on active duty. When I signed up, they put me in a reserve unit, and when I was being processed, they decided that it would be better for me to finish my training, better for the Air Force rather. And I agreed it was good for me too, to go in as a specialist. So they did delay my active duty, and I did go in as soon as I finished my last residency. So I hit Montgomery, Alabama in July 1952, and got the Air Force's indoctrination course, and
6 weeks or something for, well, they had physicians and nurses and dentists all together in this program. And they tried to make, at least give us the appearance of respectable officers, taught us how to salute, and a few things like that. It turned out while we were there, the Surgeon General was coming down to inspect or visit, so we had to have a parade for him. So they had to make us, they had to teach us to march. The cadre that did the teaching was from the Deep South, and most of us were from elsewhere, and there was a real language barrier. We couldn't understand what they were shouting at us to do, and they were getting frantic because we didn't know what we were doing, and the nurses couldn't keep up with the doctors and the dentists, and it was going to be a shambles of this parade that we had to. Of course, for them it was important. For us, it wasn't really so important. Our perspective was different. But we had our parade.
You had to go.
Well, all of the rehearsals, all the training was done without a band. At the parade, they had a band. We couldn't hear the commands at all. We finally got used to what they were saying, and we couldn't hear them.
Oh,
my. So, we were not the best marching unit. It was interesting, but it was also, there was a drought that had been going on in that part of the country, the whole south and southwest, and it was hot, and I think I mentioned the little base was adjoining Kilby Prison, which was a gruesome archetype of southern prison with the trustee with a rifle sitting under the tree in the shade and the working gangs chained together weaving the sugar cane. And that was kind of a shocking experience. Montgomery, Alabama was it was where the song Dixie was written, and you couldn't go anywhere without hearing it. And it was like being in a foreign country to some extent.
Yes.
Between the language and the customs, it did have the separate black bathrooms and drinking fountains.
Did you have to do that in your Air Force group too?
No,
when you were in
no, not in the on the base. And we were thrown together with people from everywhere, and that part was interesting. And of course, none of us took a lot of this too seriously, the military side of it, which it was necessary, we understood, but the aviation medicine part was interesting. And we were adjacent to another base, which we visited in Montgomery, but I think all of us were eager to get on. Our orders were already cut to our permanent station, and we were all sort of eager to get on with it. They tried, the colonel in charge of the program tried to persuade me, since it was under the same administrative unit, the School of Aviation Medicine, try to persuade me to stay there instead of going on to my permanent assignment in Texas at the school itself, but I turned down the offer with some trepidation, but apparently he couldn't change it. So I went on to San Antonio, Texas. And Texas is very different than the Deep South. It was southern in that it had separate and unequal facilities for blacks, but it was different. Texas had its own culture. It wasn't plantation country.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Walt, I know this is not going to be easy, but I found it fascinating to hear about your experiments and the work that you did while you were in the service. Could you please repeat that, please?
Okay. I was based at the School of Aviation Medicine, which was both a training and research organization. The research was a little startling coming from a conventional medical school environment. The names of the departments, I was told to look in on each of the departments ostensibly to make my choice of where I would be assigned, but that was really pre-assigned. But it was sort of orientation, and there was the Department of Global Epidemiology, which sounded rather presumptuous, and then there was the Department of Space Medicine. In 1952, the idea of a Department of Space Medicine, it sounded like Buck Rogers,
and right.
Pretty far out. We didn't really know what was going on, it turned out that these were real, and that the labels were not fake, that they were doing global epidemiology. If you have an Air Force that has personnel all over the world, you really do have to look a little more deeply into what's going on in the rest of the world than in the epidemiology department in the conventional medical school. And the space medicine had to do with the Air Force's interest in, ultimately, in space travel. And a lot of it was based on personnel which we, the United States, had picked up at the end of World War II from Germany. We were in a competition, actually, with our so-called allies, the Russians at that time, to get the best brains from the V-2 rocket program that the Germans had really a lead. In fact, they had the only such rockets as weapons. And we did pick up a number of them, and so the Space Medicine Department was headed by a German named Hubertus Strughold, who really was the father of space medicine in terms of studying and understanding the human capability to withstand the unique stresses of outer space.
What's his name again?
Hubertus Strughold, Strughold. Then we had other people that had worked with von Braun. Von Braun himself was also one of these. The operation, the roundup in Germany, was called Operation Paperclip, and so we knew these people as paperclip personnel. Von Braun was one, and we had a number of others that had worked with him. And some of them were very humane people that one could believe that they did what they did because it was a matter of survival. Some of them were still somewhat belligerent. My boss, I ended up in the Department of Radiobiology. My boss was a navigator. One time he originated in Arizona, in the copper mines. He was, trained in one-to-one encounters, and at one party, one of the paperclip personnel, with perhaps a little too much to drink, was describing his experiences as a personnel in the U-boat and torpedoing life rafts, and my boss decked him with one punch. So there was some problems still with the paperclip personnel, but by and large, they were a real asset. The first temporary duty I had was to go to Alamogordo, New Mexico, White Sands National Park. Was an area that was used by the Air Force. It had a branch of the Space Medicine Department, and they were doing various research studies out there. They had a track on the ground, a railroad track, and they had a sled with a rocket engine that ran on the track, and they were developing what has become the standard seatbelt configurations that were originally designed for Air Force use for space travel. A very competent medical officer was running this program, and he became convinced that what he was doing for the Air Force should be available to the population, and he was really the one who pushed the seatbelt concept in the automotive industry. They used chimpanzees, and when the chimps became a little punch drunk from absorbing the stress of sudden stops, this railroad track, I should have said, had a dead end. The sled would hit a barrier and produce what was called sudden deceleration, which means stopping short. And the protection, this was testing the protection that the seatbelts provided for the aircraft personnel. And the chimps would get a little punchy after a while, and then they were turned over to our department, where we did radiation research studies. And chimps are rather similar to humans, so our work was done primarily with rhesus monkeys and chimps. For radiation sources, we used facilities at Los Alamos National Laboratory, which was doing weapons research, and we worked in the Nevada desert at the Nevada Weapons Test Site, and we used the above-ground atomic bomb shots as source of exposure for our research studies, which were directed both at protecting our pilots from the effects of atomic weapons and producing effects of atomic weapons on the bad guys' pilots. So we were both sides of this. One side, protection was familiar to me, and that's what you do in medicine. The other side was a little less comfortable, except that there was a war going on, and we weren't doing too well in the early part of it. In fact, I don't know how well we did. We decided we had won, but it's still a divided country. So it made sense, and there was a rationale which I found acceptable to be doing this kind of work.
Dr. Wong, the experiments that you were doing, they were classified, and are they still confidential? I'm not sure if that's the correct word.
Yeah, they were classified. The things that had to do with the weapons program, even our part of it, was classified, which meant that I would have to leave my wife behind when I married. We couldn't publish the results. My department chairman, in fact, had been deprived of his PhD because he did his research at the University of Chicago during World War II, and he couldn't publish his results. So, because it was part of Manhattan Project, the Air Force had sent him, and he was learning what they needed, but at the same time, he should have been able to get his doctorate, but he couldn't publish his thesis, and you don't get a doctorate if you can't publish your results, so he didn't get his doctorate. And that was not an unusual experience, and we were in the same boat. We couldn't publish the work we were doing. On the other hand, we did have the experience of... we were doing work, as I said, on monkeys. We did also do a little work with radiation therapy patients who were getting radiation as treatment for their disease, but we weren't... I couldn't wear my uniform when I went to the hospital where this collaborative study was going on. And initially publication was limited. There was a lot of sensitivity, of course, about the Nuremberg trials were going on at that time, and even though we were piggybacking on what they would have gotten anyway, the Air Force was nervous about the relationship. The work in the desert was visited periodically by public officials, congressmen, and one day I discovered in the New Yorker, I may have been the only one in the department that subscribed to the New Yorker, even in Texas, and there was a cartoon of a monkey in an air flying an airplane in the town topics, and a couple of columns about Air Force research on monkeys and training them to fly airplanes. Apparently, one of the congressmen had been talking, and so we couldn't talk about it, but what we were doing was we trained our monkeys to simulate the operations that a pilot does when he flies an airplane, with the control mechanism, and we had the monkeys operating control levers, and the congressman interpreted that as a step towards what would you call it, not automated aircraft, but primated aircraft. And so we couldn't talk about it or publish it, but congressman could leak it, and there it was on first page of Town Topics.
Wow.
we made a certificate using the little sketch, and we all were qualified as monkey trainers with this diploma.
Right. What was your specific area of work, your focus?
Well, I was
radiation, besides radiation.
At that time, I was doing the hematologic studies. The department I subsequently discovered, although they said I could choose where I wanted to go, they had requisitioned a hematologist. The paperwork had gone to the Pentagon, computer checked available hematologists, and my name came up, and that's how I got into the area of radiation effects. It was because they needed to know about the hematologic effects of radiation. Well, I got interested also, and so when one of our consultants, a nationally famous pathologist who was also a consultant for the project of the National Academy of Sciences to study the effects of the atomic bomb on the health of survivors, he suggested that if I wanted to continue this work, I should go to Hiroshima and move up from lower primates to upper primates. And it sounded like an interesting idea, and so my wife and I decided we would go.
And what year was that?
1954, when I finished my 2-year hitch with the Air Force. I stayed 2 years and 1 month, assuming that if they ever called people back, that they'd get all the 2-year people first. And we headed from dried out San Antonio to lush green Japan.
And you were there for how many years?
We went for 2 years and decided to stay another year, so we were there
3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to tell us about your work while you were in Japan?
Yeah, it was very interesting. I was in charge of hematology. We had a number of different studies going. We were under the gun in terms of the Japanese people in the area because we only did research, they said. Well, the truth was that the Japanese government would not waive the medical licensure requirement, which involved being examined in Japanese. And to get to the level of competence where you could pass a medical examination in Japanese meant reading and writing. And even though it wasn't too hard to pick up words because the pronunciation is very simple, just consonant, vowel, but the writing is a major job of pattern recognition because each word is a symbol. The old Japanese doesn't use an alphabet, it uses a symbol for a word, which means that there's a different symbol for every word. That is a lot more complicated than learning 26 letters. Then on top of that, there's another version, a more modern version, that has symbols for syllables, so that you can make a Japanese version of a non-Japanese word, because the ideographs, the symbols for words, come from China, and they didn't have words for modern things. So there's a second Japanese language which uses symbols for syllables, and you can put them together to make words that aren't in the original language. Then there's a third version in which you transliterate them into Roman letters into English. And that's all pretty complicated, so none of us could qualify to practice in Japan, which meant all we could do was research.
Did you know that prior to your going there?
Yeah, but what we did was make rounds in the various hospitals in Hiroshima, for example, and we had access to many more pharmaceutical drugs than they had at that time. And so we would make rounds, we would supply the medications. We had Japanese physicians on our staff at the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission, and they were qualified to practice.
Right.
But we officially could not treat patients. We could, and so it was very easy to tar us with, if you want to make the U.S. look bad, they came over to experiment on us. They're only doing research. They're not doing anything to help us and all that. And there was a group, a vocal group, that took that position for political purposes. But actually, I think we did a lot of good at the time when they were at a very low ebb economically. The occupation was just ending when we got there. So they were just beginning to be confronted with the problems of standing on their own feet, and things were still a shambles in Hiroshima. We had to ride a jeep because the main street was all still torn up. It's a far cry from, I visited the last time I was there was about 2 years ago, and it's just unbelievable that they could come from where they were. People were living in, they had to reinstall the sewage system. They were still doing that. They had large sewer pipes, 8 or 10 feet high radius. And people were living in these pipes. People were living in caves in the hillsides because so much of the housing had been destroyed. So they came a long way. And
well, weren't you concerned about the air and what might be, No,
there was no residual problem. In fact, the firestorm, which was created by the bomb, burned an area which contained all of the deposited radioactivity, so it was really all dispersed. There was no residual radioactivity. That was an important issue because our troops, of course, came in within a month, and that was pretty well resolved right on at the onset. There was no residual radioactivity of any consequence. So, yeah, it's quite different than Chernobyl.
Yes. Okay.
We found extremely interesting culture. I had gone to a high school that had been founded by our first ambassador to Japan. When he came back, he became head of the Board of Education for New York City and started the first public high school. That was the one I attended. And the Japanese government had always maintained sort of a relationship. The two top students and one teacher from the high school were invited to spend the summer after the senior year in Japan as a reflection of the relationship. Of course, by the time I got to be a senior, our relationship had changed drastically, and so I missed out on the chance to go to Japan. But we had learned, you know, a little, there was a little more attention to